Well, thank you everybody for coming today. We're going to go ahead and do some Proverbs. We're going to be in this section in Proverbs, middle of chapter 22, where we left off last time. And we'll finish chapter 22 and we'll try to get into chapters 23 and 24 today. So the idea here is a section of Proverbs that called the Sayings of the Wise. It was kind of an addendum to the original book of Proverbs, so it kind of has some teachings that cover some of the same ideas as the rest of the book of Proverbs, but from a slightly different perspective, slightly different emphasis that we'll see in it. So the concept for today's class, the first part that we'll read emphasizes the idea of learning spiritual wisdom so that you can provide others with reliable words and sound answers. And then there are some Proverbs that talk about appearances versus reality. And then chapter 24 provides us with a number of thoughts on our perspectives on the sinful world as well as sinful persons, something that is kind of inevitable in our lives here is that we're going to be around the sinful and around a lot of sin. So how do we respond to it? How do we handle it? Chris is going to lead us in a short time of prayer to get ready to study, and then we'll get into some Proverbs. Amen. All right. Thanks very much. Well, let's go ahead and get into Proverbs chapter 22. Then we'll finish this chapter that we started last week. You'll notice in the text here, it says at the beginning of this passage in chapter 22, verse 17, it says, "Pay attention and listen to the sayings of the wise." This is actually was an addendum to the original book of Solomon's Proverbs, this passage that we're going to look at. It's going to be some similar ideas to what we've seen elsewhere in the book, but the ideas are fewer in number but developed a little further. Solomon's Proverbs tend to be very short and pithy. This passage develops some of the ideas in just a little bit more detail, so it's interesting as kind of another perspective on some topics that we have seen already. So we're going to read this last part of chapter 22. Let's see. Gloria, thank you so much for volunteering. Always love to hear you read. Could you read chapter 22, verses 17 to 21? And then, Isaac, why don't you pick up right after that and read 22 to 23? And then, Dot, could you finish up 24 to 29? Okay, great. That gives us some things to take a look at, and the general idea here is that we, as always, should try to understand things from a point of view of spiritual wisdom, come up with some sound, reliable words and some sound answers. And the idea that we always see is that learning wisdom in God's perspective is never about showing that we have this wisdom for wisdom's sake. It's never about trying to compete with each other to decide who's the smartest. It's always to share it with one another, to help other people to know God a little bit better. So you see an emphasis on not just learning, but also in sharing the things that we've learned. Just to point out, there's this statement that it says in verse 20, that I've written 30 sayings for you. That's actually something of an ancient reference. There was a book that was well known in the ancient world called The Wisdom of Amenemope, which was famous for its 30 chapter structures. It was this big work written by an Egyptian pharaoh with all these 30 different chapters on different areas of life. He says, we're going to reduce this just to 30 sayings, because even though Proverbs cuts deeper and is more profound, it's a lot more concise. It's not going to ramble on in excessive detail about how to manage every little area of your life the way that a worldly expert would. It's just going to put things in condensed form, points of spiritual wisdom. Now, as to the exact number of 30 sayings, whether that's literal or not, you can read the commentaries. A number of commentators have expended a great deal of paper and ink demonstrating exactly where the 30 sayings, where number one starts and number two starts and so forth. I'll leave, as we say in math, I'll leave that to you as an exercise. The point is that what he's saying is he's going to take the things that the worldly experts ramble on about in great detail and condense it and put it down into a spiritual perspective rather than a list of do's and don'ts. One of the things that he mentions then in verses 22 and 23 is one of the common themes in Proverbs and elsewhere in Scripture, where he says, do not exploit the poor because they're poor. Do not crush the needy in court, for the Lord will take up their case and will plunder those who plunder them. It's one of the things that's a consistent theme in the Scripture is to care for society's outsiders. It's one of the things that in practice, it's not that easy to do, because the world basically is run by people who are not outsiders. It's run by insiders. It's run by people who've got a lot of influence, a lot of power, and they want to keep it that way. They want to have things their way, and they want us to be focused on the things that are of interest to them. And so what we usually look at as conventional wisdom or the things that everybody believes and thinks are usually perspectives that are developed by the people who run things. And they have all kind of techniques to do that. You know, they provoke all these pointless controversies to get us mad at each other. They get involved in all these advertising campaigns with a lot of hype and screaming and telling you that your life will be ruined if you buy the wrong brand of car or if you drink the wrong brand of beer or something like that. And if you want to understand things, how they really work, you have to look a little bit below the surface. You remember the verse in Corinthians where it talks about how God will refute the wisdom of the wise. It also says, you think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were powerful or influential, but God chose the weak to shame the strong. He chose the foolish to shame the wise. That's God's perspective, is that the people who are celebrated by the world, the people who are powerful in the world, that's not really what God is all about. Because if you really get a better perspective on the world, what you see is that the people who are powerful, famous, rich, popular, they are no different from anybody else. They aren't any better than everybody else. The world's rewards are not given to people who have proved themselves more meritorious, who have a truly valuable service to offer, or a truly worthwhile talent that they're willing to give. The world's rewards are given to people who worship their gods and who are willing to accept their point of view. And it's pretty much a universal thing. Now, I could go on and on about the annoying politicians and advertisers and so forth, and about these useless Hollywood actors, and I apologize for the redundancy there, all the news media and their sensationalism. I'll actually show you a little bit of humility on my part, because it's so easy to make fun of the popular celebrities, but it goes even beneath the usual suspects. I even read once about this opera singer, Giovanni Martinelli, a famous Italian tenor, and he endorsed this brand of cigarette. There's a big ad that came out that said, I can smoke, you know, Acme cigarettes, and Acme cigarettes have never irritated my throat. And someone finally asked him, well, after a while, it's really curious, how come an opera singer would be advertising cigarettes? And how did you ever take up smoking? He said, well, I don't ever smoke. It's a terrible habit. It's horrible. They say, well, what about this ad? You said these cigarettes never irritate your throat. He says, of course not. I never smoke them. How could they irritate my throat? So even opera singers who belong to the world of culture and art, it's a cut above these ridiculous action movies that some of you characters like to watch, even they have this mentality of selling out to the world. And this is kind of the way that things are. When you look at the world, there's a lot of things like that. And rather than elaborate it with a lot of other superfluous examples, it's just a consistent emphasis in Scripture to think of things in terms of the outsiders, or even just the average person. Because when you read the news, when you listen to the people who want to be in charge of things, when you even deal with the people that you have to submit to in your workplace, you're dealing with people who don't want to deal with you as an individual. They want you to identify yourself with some kind of demographic group or some club or some interest group to which they can deal with you as a block, as a bunch of people. They don't like dealing with everyone as individuals. But in Christ, we're called to reverse that, to deal with everyone as an individual, not to identify someone by the culture that they're from, or the race that they're from, or the country that they're from, or their ridiculous political alliances, or whatever things like that are. To deal with every person you meet as an individual soul. And this is a point of view that can be difficult to instill. And this is why Proverbs puts such an emphasis on the link between common sense and self-control in the last part of this chapter. Don't make friends with a hot-tempered man. Don't associate with one easily angered, because what happens? You learn his ways. Once you get used to dealing with things by using some force or getting angry or raising your voice, what happens? You can't go back. You can't stop. You're going to do the same thing over and over again. And it's the same thing in practical affairs. Verse 26, don't be a man who strikes hands in pledge or puts up security for debts when you lack the means to pay it. You don't make impulsive decisions, whether it's financial or something else. Don't get in the habit of letting the world drag you along. And sometimes as Christians, we get confused as to our proper relationship with the world, which is a lot what the rest of these chapters are going to talk about. We end up thinking that, well, we've got to kind of separate ourselves, withdraw ourselves, just not have anything to do with this chaotic world out there. But that's too is not what God is calling us to do. He's not saying so there's all these violent people and foolish people and dishonest people, so just find a little place to hide. He's not saying that. He's saying learn to put it in its proper perspective. Learn to see through the appearances and see the reality behind the appearances. As Abraham Joshua Heschel says, our concern is not how to learn to worship in the catacombs. Our concern is to learn how to remain truly human in the skyscrapers. You know, we're stuck here. We've got to deal with the people on this earth. God loves them just as much as he loves you. And so this call to spiritual wisdom is to learn to care for each and every person, to care not just for outsiders because they're outsiders, but because they're human souls, to care for the average person not just because they're average, but because each one is an individual soul, and to learn to use a little common sense from a spiritual point of view instead of just accepting the world's conventional wisdom and all the things that they want you to believe, all the gods that every society sets up for itself. So that's kind of the introduction to this passage of the 30 sayings of the wise. We pick up now in chapter 23. We're going to read a passage about a banquet. And it's interesting, you might want to compare this to some of the parables Jesus told about using an image of a person throwing a banquet as an image of God offering things to the world. This is about a worldly person who offers a banquet of a very deceptive kind, a dishonest kind. Lloyd, could you read Proverbs, just the first 8 verses of chapter 23?
When you sit to dine with a ruler, note well what is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you are given to gluttony. Do not crave his delicacies, for that food is deceptive. Do not wear yourself out to get rich. Have the wisdom to show restraint. Cast but a glance at riches, and they are gone, for they will surely sprout wings and fly off into the sky like an eagle. Do not eat the food of a stingy man. Do not crave his delicacies, for he is the kind of man who is always thinking about the cost.
Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. If you will vomit up the little you have eaten and will have wasted your compliments.
So this passage here, it talks about a guy going to a banquet. Some person is offering this banquet and you are a guest at this banquet. And what is the basic idea here? It's a little bit confusing, I know. What sounds like the basic teaching that he's getting across here? Okay, in other words, what would be an example? Don't get carried away by this food and just snarf it on down without stopping to think about what's going on here. That's certainly one obvious lesson, is just a little restraint, all the goodies that the world offers you. What else does it advise us to do in here? Go ahead, Phil.
The cost, what it takes to get riches.
That's one of the basic teachings that it's saying, is that there's a cost to anything that you get. So you're sitting there, as Norma says, snarfing down your food at this banquet, just enjoying yourself and thinking how exciting it is that this guy has nothing better to do but to provide you with all these rich delicacies. What is your host doing?
He's counting the cost of it all.
That's right. He's sitting there thinking about how much it's costing, and what is he going to be expecting? He's going to expect something in return, isn't he? There's strings attached. There is a hidden cost. There is what economists call an opportunity cost. There are things that are going on beneath the surface. And the point that he's making is not merely limited to the literal example. It's not merely saying don't pig out at a banquet, although that's very good advice too. It's saying don't pig out on the world's treasures, because the world will offer you an endless supply of these goodies that it has. Here, you want to be powerful? Here you go. You want to be rich? Here you go. You want to have a lot of fun? Here you go. As long as you don't care about your soul, you can have all kind of stuff. And it just offers you an endless array of things, most of which are very short-lived, most of which do not really last very long, and most of which do not bring nearly the satisfaction that people think they have. The people who are the most covetous are the people who already have the most. The people who feel the deepest cravings for more are the people who already have more than enough. And it's a basic teaching of Scripture to understand the difference between the kind of rewards that the world offers versus the kind of rewards that God offers. The short-lived rewards of the world come at the highest cost, whereas the long-term rewards that God offers basically come by grace. They come for free. You know, I was talking about this guy, Amin Emopay, who wrote the 30 chapters that's being condensed down to 30 sayings. One of his sayings is, always remember that the world's riches are like geese. They have broad wings and can fly away at any time. And I'm sure that doesn't surprise you that I found that the most entertaining quote in that entire work of antiquity. But that's always something to remember. And then the other side of it, not only are the rewards short-lived, but they also come at a high cost. See, the world will tell you that they're just out to have a good time and they want you to join them. They just want you to have a good time, but that's not the truth. It always comes at a cost. They'll tell you that, oh yeah, we know how to make your life exciting and fun and filled with thrills. You do got to spend a couple $1,000s on our product, but we know how to do that. We just want to share this with you. I read an article once, a problem I was reading about, and this guy wrote, I have found the solution. You'll never have to have this problem again, and I want to share it with the world. So send me $99.95 and I'll tell you how to fix this problem in your life. That's the world's way of dealing with things. And they just get to thinking that that is the way that things are. They get to thinking that that's the way things should be. And as Christians, we of course have just as much trouble with that. Matthew 16, what good does it do for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? It's an important thing to remember. And the thing that's very insidious is it's not just the materialism per se, because that's very crass, and most of us at least know that that's foolish, even though we can't bring ourselves to stop being materialistic. At least we feel guilty about it. The problem that goes even deeper than that is this way of thinking that we always have to get something in return. People are always thinking, if I do something, I should get rewarded for it. I should get some money in exchange for it, or I should at least get praised. We have in our society this custom where people who already have far more material wealth than they need toss a tiny little fraction of it in, towards some needy cause, but they expect something in return. They expect to get their name on a building in return. They expect to get their picture on the news in return. They expect to be praised for this. Jesus exactly reversed that. He said, all the big shots dropping all the money in the temple treasury, well, so what? They don't need it. Jesus praised whom? The widow that offered something that meant something to her that was a sacrifice. Now, here's something for you to think about. Is that the way you look at people around you? Is that the people you admire? Because I know you don't. I know the kind of people you characters admire. They're wealthy, they're popular, they're famous, they already get more than enough praise and more than enough attention. And it's true even in the church. We tend not to appreciate the fact that some of the people in the church that actually to God are making the greatest sacrifices are people you barely even notice, because they're battling through their lives and facing a lot of obstacles and giving what little bit they have to be here and encourage people and to do some small things. Well, this kind of guy, you know, verse 7, he's the kind of guy who's always thinking about the cost. That applies to a lot of the way that you and I look at things. It applies to a lot of way Christians look at things. The old story about the writer George Bernard Shaw, besides being a famous writer, he was kind of renowned as being a gourmet, and someone found out that he had the secret to brewing the ideal cup of coffee, and so there was some articles in the newspaper about it, and this old farmer wrote a letter to him. Dear Mr. Shaw, I heard from a friend that you are an expert at brewing coffee, and I'd really love to have your recipe. I never seem to be able to get coffee as good as I want. So George Bernard Shaw wrote him this real snooty letter in return. He said, dear sir, assuming that you really want to know how I make coffee, here it is. And then he said, I think you're probably just using this as a clever way to get my autograph, but at least you're more creative than most of the pests I have to deal with. Yours truly, George Bernard Shaw. So a couple weeks later, Shaw gets another letter in the mail. It says, dear Mr. Shaw, thank you so much for your coffee recipe. It's delicious, and I really appreciate it very much. I do want you to know that I wrote in good faith, and so I'm returning something that you apparently prize very highly, but that is of no interest to me. And he'd snipped out Shaw's signature on the letter and enclosed it with it. And you see, that's just the mentality that we fall into. Once you start living in that world of the way that the world wants you to deal with things, always getting something in return, always counting the cost, you just assume everyone else is that way too, don't you? You don't trust anybody. You don't respect anybody. And you don't really appreciate the things people do for you because you're just thinking that it's due to you. And this is what that verse means, is the kind of guy who's always thinking about the cost, kind of guy who's always thinking what's due him. And so in the middle of this chapter, it calls us to watch, to listen, and to learn. It talks about taking a good look at things and realizing how things are done and the kind of things that we need to deal with things. Verse 15 and 16, if your heart is wise, then my heart will be glad. My inmost being will rejoice. Rejoicing in the inward being is one of the hallmarks of spiritual wisdom. Rejoicing when we can share grace. Rejoicing when we see grace. Rejoicing not when we see somebody accomplish some worldly feat, but rejoicing when we can see someone show a little grace to someone else. Being more excited when we see someone show a small act of compassion and mercy than when we see someone accomplish some great sporting feat or accumulate power for themselves. That's the things that mean something to God. And that kind of perspective can be very difficult to come by. Rejoicing in the gracious things. Verse 17, do not let your heart envy sinners, but always be zealous for the fear of the Lord. Envying sinners is a common thing that we have to deal with. When we look around the world, you're going to see a lot of very sinful people getting a lot out of it. We can't expect that the things of God are always going to bring worldly returns, but they do bring returns inwardly, rejoicing in our inmost being. As Proverbs itself often says, the riches of spiritual wisdom are greater than gold. They're greater than silver. They're greater than jewels. And that's a thing that is very hard for us to remember. We say it all the time, but the point is, do we believe it? And believing it, it'll tip you off in your attitude towards these kind of things, the kind of people you admire, the kind of ways that you look at your brothers and sisters in the church, whether you look at the sinful people of the world and get angry, or whether you look at them and feel sorry for them and feel pity and compassion and want to have their sins forgiven instead of punished. A lot of things that it says in this chapter we don't have time to talk about, but we'll just point them. This verse 10 is something Proverbs actually says a number of times. It says, don't move an ancient boundary stone or encroach on the fields of the fatherless, for their defender is strong. He'll take up their case against you. That was a common trick that wealthy people used to play at the time. If you had a little bit of influence in the courts, they used to use stones to mark their property. And the wealthy person would be able to go into court and say, I think that stone's rolled a few dozen yards from its original place. I think it really belongs over there. And if you had enough influence, you could get a judge to say, yes, you're right, I can tell. Evidence shows that it really was over there. And so you just get them to move the boundary stone a few hundred yards over there to take property away from your helpless neighbor. It's a common trick that was used, but it's really, of course, no different from our own legal system. Basically, our legal system, as Abe Lincoln used to say, supposed to be government of the people, by the people, and for the people. But we actually have government of the lawyers and lobbyists, by the lawyers and lobbyists, for the lawyers and lobbyists. And if you have enough influence, if you have enough money, you can get what you want. And what it's saying is, as Christians, as believers, don't do that, even in little ways. Just because you can get something doesn't mean you should get it. Just because you can do something, pull some trick on somebody, doesn't mean you should. It's one of my wife's favorite lines from the movie Jurassic Park, when these scientists created all these dinosaurs, and then they got loose and started eating people. And the one guy at the very beginning was warning them not to do this, and he said, look, you guys are so caught up with proving what you can do that you're not even thinking about what you should do. But you see, as Christians, we do the same thing. We think, well, we can do this. We can accomplish something by resorting to a little bit of force, a little bit of manipulation, a little bit of deceit, and it's what God wants. So it's good, right? But what he's saying is, no, don't envy the sinners. Don't cheat people. Don't neglect to live a life of self-discipline. Don't get into these bad habits. Don't hang around with violent people. And what he's saying then is just to take a good look at the world and see what it's really like. As Yogi Berra used to say, the great baseball player, who was even a greater producer of snappy quotes, he used to say, you can observe a lot in this life just by watching. Yeah. If you just sit and look sometimes at this world and the way it really works, you can put things in a lot better perspective. But what happens is the world is always so busy, they're always screaming so loud, they're always advertising something or pressuring you into doing something, that we just let ourselves be pushed back and forth, as Ephesians says, blown here and there by the waves of the world's scheming. And he's just cautioning us, stop and look and listen. Spiritual wisdom is very sweet. Sometimes it can be a little inconvenient, like the passage in Revelation about the little book that John ate that was so sweet in his mouth, but when it got to his stomach, it turned a little bitter sometimes. It takes a little bit of self-control to look at things in a little bit different way. The passage that ends this chapter is interesting too. It talks about the drunkard's dilemma. It talks. We'll pick up here in verse 30. Those who linger over wine, who go to sample bowls of mixed wine, don't gaze at wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. For in the end it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights and your mind will imagine confusing things. You'll be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on top of the rigging. They hit me, you will say, but I'm not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. When will I wake up so I can find another drink? It's talking about this foolish drunkard who went out on a bender, and now he's got a hangover, and he feels terrible, and what's his solution to it? I need another drink. Now, not too many of you are drunks. A couple of you I wonder about, but not too many of you are drunks. So this is one of those great passages in the Bible where we can just feel wonderful about ourselves. We spent a couple minutes bashing drunks, right? No. See, what it's saying, it's not just about drunkenness. It's about the habit of using the quick fix, the habit of using the quick, getting the quick rewards, and how it lets you down. Because we do the same thing. It's just the same for things, of course, of other sensual sins, drunkenness and other sensual things, but it's also true of things like materialism. Once you resort to trying to use money to solve all your problems and make you feel secure, you can't get out of the trap. You'll answer every question by saying, how can I get a little bit more money? Once you start using anger and force and violence to try to force your way on other people, you can't stop. It's always going to be an excuse. You're always going to rationalize it from then on. You know, we have all kind of things in our nation's history where, because a long time ago we decided that it's okay to kill people if they're wrong, then that's the quickest and easiest way to solve problems, isn't it? And all those things are just the same as the drunkard's dilemma. Once you get used to solving your problems that way, that's the quickest and easiest thing, and so you're always going to do that. And so the question that he's saying is, don't even get started on that. Don't dwell on how sparkling and exciting that wine looks. Just realize, hey, it's a bad idea to go down that road. It's a downward spiral. Chapter 24 will give us some more perspectives on the sinful. The beginning of the chapter, do not envy wicked men, do not desire their company, for their hearts plot violence and their lips talk about making trouble. The contrast, by wisdom a house is built, and through understanding it is established. Through knowledge its rooms are filled with rare and beautiful treasures. And it talks about how wisdom can overcome evil, but not in the crass way that we want it to. We're always hoping that somehow, if we just say the right thing, if we just do something righteous enough, everyone else will just say, wow, we're going to do it God's way from now on. And that's not reality. But you can have a victory. You can overcome evil through wisdom in a way that might not be as satisfying to the flesh, but it means even more to God. Is you can live in the middle of an evil, sinful world and overcome the temptation to be like that. You can be a beacon of grace and light and truth and compassion in a world that's filled with hate and anger. That to God is a bigger victory than all the little things that we want to argue about, than all the little ways that we want to try to force our views on other people. The fact that you can protect your heart, keep your heart free of all this worldly filth, and I don't just mean filth in terms of your drunkenness and immorality, but the filth of materialism and hatred and anger and prejudice, that's a tremendous victory to God. You might not consider it a tremendous victory, but God does. You might find it more exciting when your team wins the Super Bowl, or when your guy wins an election, or when somebody is forced to do things your way, but God thinks it's more of a victory when you just protect your heart from being made into another person living with sinful, materialistic, ugly attitudes. And this chapter gives us, so we don't have time to read the whole thing, but this chapter also kind of points out some things that we can look at in our views of other people. Verse 10 says something interesting. If you falter in times of trouble, how small is your strength? See, these rare and beautiful treasures that we have, they are things that we value very little, unfortunately, most of the time, because they don't cost anything. We're no better than anyone else. We're Americans. We judge everything based on its price tag. And the things God gives you that are worth the most come free. And so we tend to denigrate them. We tend not to appreciate how valuable are. The things that other people do for you that don't cost anything, you tend not to appreciate how valuable they are. It goes back to 23 verse 7. Always thinking about the cost. Always thinking about how much something is, quote, worth in human terms. But you know, it's when you have trouble in your life, when you're left alone, when you have a problem you can't realize how to solve, when you're being mistreated, being misjudged, that's when you find out if you have the real faith. And that's when you find out if you really have the right perspective on things. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's when you find out how little all the material things of the world really value you in times of spiritual crisis. Old story by Leo Tolstoy called The Master and the Servant, in which there's this wealthy landowner who has found out that there's a grove available over in the next county that's for sale at a real bargain price. And he finds out about this and he thinks, oh, this guy that owns that, oh, he's a fool. He's selling it for a cheap price. And so he wants to race off and buy it. It's right in the middle of this big religious festival, and he's actually at one of the top officials at his church, and so he's got to kind of rush through all the religious ceremonies and chase people away from the church so that he can get quickly rush over to the neighboring county and buy this land before somebody else snaps it up from him. And so he gets his servant to hitch up his sleigh. This is Tolstoy's era, was in old Russia. And so hitch up his sleigh and race off to get this. And he has this really gentle, faithful servant who's real good with the horse, and he's real helpful and humble. And so they race off to do this, and it starts snowing. And it's one of these huge blizzards that comes up in Russia a lot. And so very quickly, it becomes very dangerous to get going. And his servant says, "Your master, we're not going to be able to see the road. We should really go back." No. I got to buy this. I got to buy this grove. I got to get there before anybody else snaps it up. Well, they get lost, and they end up in this town where they know some people, and they're, so everybody says, look, it's a big snowstorm. Who's going to go out in the snowstorm? You know, it's going to be waiting for you when the snow ends. No, 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 someone else might be closer already, and they'll get there first. So he goes right back out again. It just snows harder and harder and harder, and so they get lost again, and they end up back in the same town. And so this time he starts to think about it a little bit, and so the servant sits around and has it talks and tells stories with some of the servants, and the master thinks, well, maybe we should stay here for a while, gets into a political argument with the people whose house he's staying at, gets mad at them, and decides, okay, well, we're going to get back on the road here. So they get back on the road again, and they get completely stuck. The snow just piles up too much. They can't go anyplace. So they're just stuck. And the servant says, you know, I'm real sorry. You know, we're going to have to stop. And so he sets the master up in the sleigh, you know, with all his expensive furs and everything on him, and gets the master all set up. And then the servant digs out a little hole for him in the snow, and he's got this ratty old coat. And so he just tries to cover himself. We use the snow to protect himself from new snow coming down. And so the servant just falls asleep. Okay, you know, there's nothing better to do. Probably going to die, but what can you do? And this rich guy sitting in the sleigh, and he tries to comfort himself by thinking about all the things he owns. So I've got this great house, and I have a shop, and I have a couple of stores, and I have this brand new barn with this iron roof that I put on. And he's thinking about all the money he has, and pretty soon I'm going to buy this grove, and I'm going to cut down all the trees, and we're going to use it to build this, and I'm going to make so much money. And he starts to thinking, and then he hears the whipping of the wind and the snow, and he hears wolves starting to howl, and he starts to panic, and he starts to realize all that money is not going to do much good if the wolves are coming after him. And he looks over at this servant sleeping there and says, what a fool, he can sit there and sleep at a time like this, and it's because it's such a worthless person, doesn't have anything. And he starts to get mad. He starts saying, that guy doesn't have a house, he doesn't have any shops or stores, he's not going to buy a grove and cut down the trees and make money, his life's useless, mine is important, mine is valuable. So he takes the horse, unhitches it from the sleigh, and dashes off, just leaves the servant there to die. And he goes dashing off. Well, the horse does not like him. The horse has gone all this way in this terrible weather because the servant and the horse have a real close relationship. So he's not too interested in taking this rich guy anyplace. So he's whipping the horse and whacking him and hurting him, and the horse is doing his best to get going, and finally the horse just gives up and sits down, and he finds out that the horse brought him back to where the servant was. The horse didn't want to be left alone from the servant, and this rich guy, for a moment, he really is really furious now and really in a panic, and then he hears the servant calling to him, and he says, I'm sorry, master, I'm going to die. Would you like my coat? Could you please give any money you owe me to my son? And all of a sudden, he just has this complete change of perspective. He just sees how this poor person with nothing can be so calm and other-centered in a time of crisis. And all of a sudden, he just is overwhelmed by a feeling of compassion. And he says, no, no, you can't die. You can't die. And he takes off all his expensive furs, and he puts them on this poor servant. And then he even lays down on top of him to warm him up. And it's a very interesting story. The climax of the story, he's doing this, and now he feels himself starting to drift away because he's dying. Now the rich guy ends up dying to save this poor guy. And he hears someone calling him. He says, as he heard the call, he thought about his money, about his shops, about his home, about the barn with the iron roof, about the groves he was going to buy, about all the money that he would make. And he remembered that there was this man called Brekhanov, that's his name. And he remembered there used to be a man named Brekhanov who thought all these things were so important. And he wondered why this man Brekhanov would think they were so important. I guess he just didn't know anything. Now, I think we know it was all a mistake. Now I know. And again he heard the voice calling him, come, come. And he said, I'm coming. He said joyfully, he said peacefully, I'm coming, I'm coming. And he felt that now he was free, and that now he could be truly at one with himself. And it's a touching example of how the worldly stuff that we rely on so much, it lets you down. And the real treasures in life are human treasures, because God has poured out his Spirit into each one of us. And the things that we need to try to recognize in the world are the human beings, even when they're people that we don't like. They've done things that upset us, disgust us, anger us. And the middle of this chapter has a few little things I'll just point out. I'll let you take a look at them more on your own. Verse 11, rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those straggling towards slaughter. You're the doomed of the world. Have some compassion on them, even if you think they deserve it. Down in verse 15, don't lie in wait like an outlaw against a righteous man's house. Don't raid his dwelling place. For though a righteous man falls seven times, he rises again, but the wicked are brought down by calamity. Once again, you know, the violence that we so often rationalize when we think it's in a good cause. Just don't get caught up in it. Verse 17, don't gloat when your enemy falls. When he stumbles, don't let your heart rejoice, for the Lord will see and disapprove and turn his wrath away from him. Now, there's an interesting one for some of you characters who kind of make a hobby out of hating people who, in the world, who do things you don't like. It says, if you gloat when he has a problem, what's God going to do? He's going to have mercy on him. So there's a little something for some of you characters to think about. Successful sinners are very common in this world. But what we're being taught in Proverbs is to reverse the perspective of the world and realize the treasures we have and that we don't need to envy the successful sinners. And it gives a closing to this passage here that just talks about impartiality and honesty in verse 23. These also are sayings of the wise. To show partiality in judging is not good. And it talks about an honest answer is like a kiss on the lips. Just to look at things impartially. We so often devise our beliefs based on our self-interest. And that's why so many people are so loud and angry in trying to push their beliefs on other people. It's because their beliefs really are not based on the calm assurance of truth, but on what you want to be true because it serves your self-interest. And that's why so many of these debates that the world gets into and so many of these controversies, there really is very little substance to so much of them. They're really just battles between two groups of self-interested persons, or one group of self-interested persons and another group of self-righteous persons, which is no better at all from God's point of view. But don't we get just as caught up in that as anybody else? Because we let ourselves be dragged into it because we perceive that our self-interest is at stake, or someone's not doing things the way that we think they should and we're offended by that, or because the world has convinced us that it's some crisis that needs to be dealt with. And what he's saying is just form your points of view on things as best as you can using spiritual, impartial wisdom, and be honest. And there's a little parable at the end, starting in verse 30. I went past the field of the sluggard, past the vineyard of the man who lacks judgment. Thorns had come up everywhere. The ground was covered with reeds, and the stone wall was in ruins. I applied my heart to what I observed and learned a lesson from what I saw. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, scarcity like an armed man. You can compare that, by the way, with Isaiah chapter 5 and with these vineyard parables that Jesus told, which take a different tack altogether. Another parable about laziness, our old friend the sluggard. And so here again, this is one of those great passages that if you don't consider yourself particularly lazy, we can enjoy ourselves at the sluggard's expense, can't we? Well, he's not talking about the proper technique in creating a fruitful vineyard physically. He's talking about how to live your life spiritually. Because the sluggard is not just a physical sluggard. A sluggard can be a spiritual sluggard. Just going along lazily with the things the world teaches you because you don't want to reevaluate what's happening out there. You just want to believe that the people who are famous and powerful got there because they're better than somebody else, and so we'll just do things their way. You really believe that the way to success is to accumulate material things and to get your way and to win arguments. And if you never question that, your spiritual vineyard becomes just as run down and beaten up as the sluggard's vineyard. And that's worse than not having anything physically. That's worse than physical poverty. Spiritual poverty is far worse. And so it's a call not to condemn lazy physical persons, but to be forewarned not to be lazy spiritually, not to let the world's perspectives creep into your mind, not to let the world drag you along when they're upset or angry with each other or giving in to violence and materialism and prejudice. It's a call to be on your guard for your heart, to remember the treasures that you have, and to have a different perspective on the world, a perspective not of being angry and hateful, but of being compassionate and piteous towards those people. Trivia time. We'll get our trivia question in before we go on. This is word history trivia, or etymology trivia is a technical term. What is the origin of the word Tuesday as the name for a day of the week? You use this word a lot, right? Tuesday and Wednesday and all, Monday and everything. Well, I gave you five choices, and they're all good ones. Do you think that the name Tuesday comes from the number 2, since it is the second day of the work week? You think that's why it's called Tuesday? Do you think that it comes from the Latin word to, or, you know, it's the same word in Spanish and Italian and French, because it was originally your day? That's why it's called Tuesday. It was originally dues day, because that's the day of the week on which bills were traditionally paid. You think that's why it's called Tuesday? Do you think it's named after Tu, the Norse god of war and law? Or do you think it comes from a word that means vegetables to recognize the traditional day of going to the market? That's getting some points with Linda right there. The reason I ask this question is because Christians are always being dragged into these little crusades, even when we can avoid the silly arguments of the world. We're always getting dragged into these little crusades of being offended by something. You know, we're offended by something someone wants to do, or we're offended by a movie, we're offended by a book someone wrote, we're offended by something someone proposes as a law or something, and we're always finding these secret satanic agendas behind things. You know, we're always boycotting stuff or wanting someone to be punished. And the thing that we often forget is that pagan culture and sinfulness is woven into the very fabric of this world. It's a fallen world. And long ago, this world became overwhelmed by sin. And to live in this world trying to stamp out sin and convict people of sin and get angry about it is just a silly thing to do. The word Tuesday comes from this so-called god, Tu, the Norse god of war and law. That's his English name. His old English name is Tu. In Old Norse, it's Tyr. It was this god. But the first day of the week, Sunday, is the sun's day. Second is the moon's day, because ancient people worshipped the sun and the moon. And then they just named the other days after stuff they worshipped also. Tuesday is Tuesday, the god of war and law. Wednesday is Woden's day, or Odin, the king of the gods. Thursday is Thor's day, the god of thunder and lightning. Friday is Freya's day, the queen of the gods. Saturday is Saturn's day, after the Roman god Saturn. Every time you use the word Tuesday, you're honoring the memory of this pagan god. And just to tell you a little bit more about this character, he's always depicted in medieval art as missing his right hand and half of his right arm. That's because one of the famous Norse myths is there was this huge wolf, Fenric, who was an enemy of the gods, and he was doing all kind of nasty things. And so the gods decided they needed to make this magic chain and bind up this wolf, Fenric. And they appointed two to keep the wolf busy while the other gods put this chain around him. And this guy, too, apparently was not the sharpest crayon in the box, because the only thing he could think of to keep this wolf busy was to stick his hand in the wolf's mouth while the other gods were tying the chain around him. So that's why he never has a hand. Now, I don't really know what's the best way of keeping a wolf busy while other people chain him, but I know that's not it. So that gives you an idea of what kind of a guy this was. And I remember the first time I read this story thinking how appropriate it was that they put a twit like this in charge of wars and laws, because that's very fitting to have a guy like that in charge of all the wars. Well, every time you use the word Tuesday, you're honoring the memory of this guy who, first of all, didn't really exist, and even if he did exist, he was a real half-wit. So that tells you what a lot of our language does. And every time you use the other days of the week, you're honoring these other gods. So does that mean we should stop doing it? Does that mean we need to have a campaign? I'm offended that Christians should have to call the name. We need to rename the days of the week. Sunday is going to be Jesus Day. Monday is going to be Paul Day. Tuesday is going to be John Day. And all these people out there need to obey us and start doing this. Isn't that exactly the way that you and I react to stuff? Isn't that exactly what we do? It's silly and it's ridiculous. We have to live in this world. God is not infuriated by all these little things. God doesn't just sit up there. They still haven't figured out that Tuesday is the name of this stupid pagan god. I can't believe no one's changed it yet. He just thinks, isn't that a laugh? That's just the way this world is. We name things after people who are just ridiculous characters. It's not just the days of the week. It's a lot of other things. Do you know our national anthem? Do you know where the tune from that came? It's an old boozing song. It's an old drinking song that commemorates the memory of the Greek poet Anacreon, who was famous for being a drunk and writing poems about being drunk. And the original song, the original tune, used to talk about how much fun it is to get drunk and go out and do a lot of irresponsible things. And when Francis Scott Key wrote the words to the national anthem, he always loved singing that song, and so he put it to that song. Now, does that mean that we can no longer sing the national anthem because every time we do, that it's commemorating a drunk? When you go to a baseball game and they play it, should you stand up? Excuse me, everybody. This song commemorates drunkenness. We need to stop it. We need to sing a hymn instead here. See, once you get on that campaign, it becomes highly selective. And this is the problem with all this moral outrage that Christians are so fond of. It's not that some of these things aren't ridiculous. It's that there's so much of it. It's woven into the fabric of this world. This world is fallen. It's okay to live in it. It's okay to be close to the people down here. Just learn to have compassion for it. Learn to see it for what it is, that the spirituality in this world is so lacking. And instead of arguing and debating things, pass along a little bit of the grace and peace and love that we've been given in God. Pass along a little bit of the real treasure. Don't just yell at them about how sinful they are. Show them what God is really like. Pass along a little bit of that light. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you for your patient attention, and we'll continue with Proverbs next time.